WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Another Biden business insider is coming forward, this time someone who says he moved money around for the corrupt first family. Ohioans just defeated a measure that would have made it harder to change the state constitution, and American soldiers are stationed in an African country that just went through a coup. Those stories are coming up. But first, it turns out that less than a month before the 2020 general election, Michigan authorities were investigating a suspected voter fraud operation. This is according to hot-off-the-press investigative reporting from the Gateway Pundit, which attached two full reports by the Michigan police in their story. In mid-October of 2020, the Muskegon City clerk notified police that someone dropped off between 8,000 and 12,000 completed voter registration applications. The clerk says she saw this person drop off 2,500 forms in just one day. She told Muskegon police that she believed some of the forms were fraudulent because they looked like they were filled out by the same person. And she also said the addresses on many of the forms didn't exist, and when they didn't belong to residential homes. The city clerk also discovered that the phone numbers on some forms were erroneous and that signatures didn't match those on file with the Department of Secretary of State. A Michigan Secretary of State official confirmed that a quantity of the forms were clearly fraudulent. Officers interviewed people who supposedly filled out the forms. Some of them denied having signed the form, and in other cases, they said they never completed any part of the form. Michigan police questioned the woman who was seen dropping off the voter registration applications in Muskegon. She told police she was paid $1,100 a week to find unregistered voters and provide them with a form so they can register to vote or get their absentee ballot. She was paid through a reloadable pay card. Police say she was nervous when talking to them and that she had a few inconsistencies in her story. Two members of the Michigan Attorney General's Criminal Investigation Division were assigned to the operation before the entire thing was taken over by the FBI, where it seems to have died. But before that happened, the Muskegon police found out that the lady who dropped off the voter forms was working for an organization called GBI Strategies, a company connected to the Biden campaign and other Democrat campaign committees. FEC filings showed that GBI Strategies received millions of dollars from far-left organizations. And it looks like this company set up similar operations in multiple swing states. Michigan State Senator Ruth Johnson, who's a former Secretary of State, told the Gateway Pundit, "My estimate is over 800,000 ballot applications were sent to non-qualified voters in Michigan." Donald Trump lost Michigan in 2020 by 150,000 votes. The previous election, he won it by 15,000 votes. Join me to discuss today's stories is Executive Senior Editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Paul.
So, you happened upon this story, and I looked into it yesterday, and it was very interesting. I feel like the further we get away from that 2020 election, the more we can say, man, something was really wrong with that election. I have a few issues with it, but maybe I'll let you get in here first, and then I'll tell you my thoughts on it.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, the election was fraudulent, and how it was done was shown, I think, very ably by the already memory-hold movie by Dinesh D'Souza, 2,000 Mules.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very clear how it was done. And this is obviously one of the mules under consideration.
Absolutely. What do you make of it? And I think this is the strongest sticking point, is that courts looked at this. And supposedly some of them said there's no merit to this, while others said there's no standing and they didn't even look at it. What do you make of that point?
Well, I think there's, you know, the legal ramifications aside, there's a very, very strong cultural bias in the United States to the effect that we are not corrupt. That's something that happens in other countries where people speak different languages, have different cultures. Whatever, you know, third world countries, banana republics, and so forth. But certainly not here. Everything we do is above board. Yeah, there may be a little bit here and there in the inner cities, but they don't count. But by and large, you know, the idea, and that's really what happened after the election of 2020. We went in a matter of a couple of days to how in the world did that happen? You know, we all went to bed with Trump well ahead in most of these swing states. It was pretty clear that he had won the election and woke up the next – well, you woke up. I was actually living in the other side of the world at the time, so I watched this in real time. But you woke up the next day. Oh, what? He actually lost, and he lost big in all these critical states. Mm-hmm. And then all this other stuff came out quickly, all these weird videos of people going in, you know, getting all the Republican poll watchers out and then wheeling out of hiding all these big, you know, containers of new ballots and so forth. All this stuff, but nothing to see here, folks. And after a couple days, you know, and I let me just say also, I'm from the state of Pennsylvania. I know a lot about Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania cannot have more than about 2 million actual registered voters or so, mm-hmm. more than that. And the fact that Trump, on the election night, before everyone went to bed and the counting was stopped, supposedly, was leading by over 600,000 in Pennsylvania. Okay, that's a very large percentage of the entire electoral base. And yet somehow the next morning, that number had flipped entirely.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, I'm not a fool. Millions of other Americans aren't a fool. We know what happened. But and what happened in the press was, and this includes Fox News, by the way, is that, you know, for a couple of days, the likes of Fox News were allowed to speculate, well, how did this looks like fraud to us. And then all of a sudden, oh, no, it's not fraud. And the courts and everybody else have said it so. End of story, nothing to see here. And what's missing is there were never any stories in the news that said, okay, well, it sure looked at first glance like it was fraud because all of these strange anomalies were taking place, but here's what actually happened and here's the explanation for it. We never got that story. We didn't get it in the New York Times or anywhere else. You know, there was no one that said, well, you know, we can understand why people might be misled to understand this, but in point of fact, here's what actually took place.
Yeah,
there's that missing link.
Well, they
was never brought in.
They tried to do. They had that narrative, the most secure election in the history of the United States. Right? Remember that. And one of the things they told us, and this is where I'm going to go through my list of suspects here. One of the things they told us is that the machines were not connected to the internet,
sure.
which then turned out to be a lie, and now, you know, it's mainstream news. I was talking about with this over the internet with someone the other day, and you just put it in there, and boom, there's an NBC article saying, yes, they are in fact connected. So they lied to us about that. Also, in that election, the Census Bureau found 5 million fewer voters than the number of ballots counted. And apparently, this is the largest gap recorded since post-election surveys began in 1964. In 2016, census voting data matched almost precisely the number of ballots counted. 18 of 19 bellwether counties went for Trump. In Arizona, which we reported on the Cyber Ninja's partial investigation before it was cut short, there were more than 200,000 corrupt images of ballots that were found, which basically means with an audit, you don't know. The margin of victory there was only 10,000. And so there's that, and there's many more. But like you said, we saw these documentaries where people are dropping off these truffles of ballots in the middle of the night. And now we have this story, and this is just a smidget, it seems like, of this operation by GBI.
Well, you know, if I might, I mean, what you have on the one hand are what you're arguing is evidentiary. You're saying, well, here's all the evidence that says one thing. And on the other side, you have pretty much the totality of the media cartel and obviously all of the Democrats and some of their accomplices within the so-called rhinos have formed this united front and said, no, none of it's true because the courts say so, we say so, people we respect say so. In other words, they're using one of the oldest logical fallacies in the world, which is the argument by authority. Which may be appropriate in a theological context, mm-hmm. to say, for example, well, you know, I believe thus and such because the Bible says so, or something like that. That's fine, but as a logical argument, admissible in a court of law, it doesn't hold up. But that's what people are saying, and so why do they get away with it? I think because in the first instance, Americans are just, particularly those who have a vested interest in the maintenance of the status quo, are just aghast at any prospect that indeed we could be this corrupt, that something like this could happen. Therefore, it never happened. Shut up, I don't want to hear it. And because, oh, by the way, I have a law degree, or I'm an important person in the media, or I'm a politician, yeah, stand, and I say it's not so, therefore it's not so.
Right.
That's what it amounts to.
Right. One last point is, this has happened before. It's been documented, the JFK victory, was it 60, 62? He took Texas 16. And Illinois. He bought votes there. That certainly happened. And of course, LBJ won in Texas earlier. I think it was a Senate seat. That now, even the AP and everyone has acknowledged that was a stolen race. And there's other we could go over, but we're going to run out of time. So I'm going to go to our next story here. Well, most Americans are familiar with the name Eric Schwerin, but they will be soon. Schwerin was another Hunter Biden business associate, and he'll probably soon testify about the Biden's financial transactions, which he was allegedly very involved with. It looks like Schwerin moved money around for the Bidens to a much greater extent than Devin Archer. From 2009 onward, Schwerin visited the White House often, where he most likely met with then-Vice President Joe Biden. Here's Maria Bartiromo with Peter Schweitzer of the Government Accountability Institute and Tennessee Congressman Tim Burchett discussing Schwerin.
Well, we've got more connections to report between Joe Biden and Hunter's business deals. Fox News Digital revealing that Eric Schwerin, who is Hunter's longtime business partner, visited the Obama White House and Joe Biden's vice presidential residence at least 36 times between 2009 and 2016. The president of the Government Accountability Institute, Peter Schweitzer, joined me on Sunday Morning Futures on Sunday, saying that Schwerin was in control of the Biden money.
I would add the next shoe that may drop is there's another individual involved with Hunter Biden named Eric Schwerin. He's the guy that moved money around. And based on the Hunter Biden laptop, Schwerin had access not only to Hunter Biden's accounts, but also Joe Biden's accounts.
Joining me right now is Tennessee Congressman Tim Burchett. He is a member of the House Oversight and Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman, good to see you this morning. We are waiting to see what shoe drops next here. We know that Eric Schwerin is going to be testifying in front of Jim Jordan's committee. What are your thoughts on what we're learning now about Hunter Biden's business affairs and how much Joe Biden was involved?
I think, first of all, Mr. Schwerin's testimony is going to be imperative to what's going on. You know, he is controlling the Biden family's money, and the visits that he made, of course, to the Naval Observatory, which is where the vice president lives. You know, I've been in Congress 5 years, Maria, and I've been there one time. This guy was there at least 36 times. So there's clearly some involvement there, and the money trail just never seems to end.
Money trail just never seems to end. That may be the case, but it does seem to lead in one direction. Steve, what's it going to take to get an impeachment investigation into this guy?
Well, I do laud the House, the people in the Oversight Committee and the Judiciary Committee, yeah, that are doing this. They're being very methodical. They're producing evidence, unlike what happened with Trump. There's no partisan rush to judgment, although I think a lot of us probably already know and have known for many years that the Biden family is corrupt to the bone. That this kind and they're not the only ones either. We hasten to add this kind of pay to play stuff is endemic in Washington. It's the reason that so many Washington politicians, particularly Democrats, who are uniquely prone to traffic in this sort of thing, come to office as ordinary people.
And they get rich.
And they spend decades in office, and they retire millionaires. I mean, we mentioned LBJ, and he, no one knows how he made millions as a politician. So this is not a new thing. The scope of and the audacity of the corruption is breathtaking. And the only – and it is a slender reed indeed that the Democrats, who continue to defend him, are resting upon is, well, we still haven't found any direct evidence of a payment to Joe Biden himself. Okay, well, I venture to predict that we won't. Okay, we're going to continue to have lots of testimony and lots of other evidence, but you're probably going to wait a long time to find an actual payment of, let's say, $500,000 from some corrupt poobah in Kazakhstan, mm-hmm, directly to an account owned by Joe Biden. And even the Bidens are not going to be that clumsy.
Yeah, and that's why, okay, he said, where's the money? And
but
he laughed off.
Sure, absolutely. But that said, when you contrast this with the very real, partisan witch hunt that was conducted against Donald Trump on the flimsiest possible pretext, and which, of course, continues apace even as we speak, with what's going on with Biden. I mean, the double standard is blindingly apparent.
Yes. Speaking of, when can we expect the next Trump indictment? If this goes,
Any day now, I'm sure. Well, I think, sure. I mean, we hold that in abeyance until the next, you know, riveting round of testimony appears on YouTube and the commentariat and Fox News and elsewhere are out there circulating it and making a big deal of it. And then another, another indictment will drop. I mean, this is horrifying stuff, Paul. This is truly what goes on in banana republics. Again, referring to our previous story.
Right.
This happens as a matter of routine. We're going to talk in the next segment about a particular African country where this kind of thing is endemic. And, you know, in many parts of the world, people just shrug and accept it and understand that, you know, the ruling class behaves in this manner and there's not a whole lot they perceive that can be done about it. The difference is that at least in theory, Americans nurture this, you know, this conceit long held that, well, the government belongs to the people. And that we can hold our, you know, our rulers, we often use that term ill-advisedly, our ruling class to account. And what this episode has shown so far is that, no, actually, we really can't at this point, the way things are. Because this is not a new thing. You know, we had similar stuff happening with the Clintons a generation ago, and more recently with the Hillary Clinton, you know, the email stuff and all that. You know, this is not something that just suddenly, you know, burst into view with the Bidens. It's been going on for a while. The effort to hold these people to account is not novel either, and yet they never seem to be held to account.
Right. And I think part of what we're witnessing, though, is this tension between the American public, who seems to still be under the impression that this is their government, and then the government and, you know, high-powered officials saying, trying to bring the message out. It's like, oh, no, we're in charge now. I don't know how else to tell you this besides just coming out.
And the real reason that the protests are muted in official Washington, including among many Republicans who are reluctant to really, you know, to pull on all the threads in the Biden scandal, is that many of them do it, and most of them see nothing wrong with it. They will say privately, well, yeah, of course we know everybody does this stuff. You know, it happens every now and then. You have a little scandal, blow off steam. The public feels like justice is done, but this is the way politics is done. This is the nature of Washington. Deal with it. Such is the level of cynicism inside the Beltway.
That's just such a good point, because a lot of them, are reluctant to push on this because they do the same kind of thing.
They're either involved themselves in similar schemes, or they just don't really see, they've been, you know, become inured to it because they've seen it so much that they just accept it as a matter of course.
Thank you, Steve. Well, hey, folks, have you made plans to attend the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference this September? If not, you should. This year, we'll be gathering in Des Moines, Iowa, and we'll be discussing effective strategies that you can use in your activism, and we'll bring plenty of materials that you can take back home with you. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet like-minded patriots. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, whose discussion topic will be the death of science, medical freedom in an era of lies. James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, he'll also be there, and on Friday we'll be doing dinner and watching his movie. Former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King will join us as well, as will renowned physicist and election expert Dr. Douglas Frank. The New American's Alex Newman, he'll be there, and he'll be talking about how climate change is used to scare and control people. And that's just a very brief summary of all that will be happening over those 2 days. You can learn more about this conference and get your tickets at jbs.org. If you prefer, you can call for your tickets, 1-800-527-8721. But hurry up, because that ticket window will be closing soon. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or by calling 800-527-8721. Stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom.
Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. Ohio voters just defeated a measure that would have made it more difficult to amend the state constitution. Right now, majority voters from half of Ohio's counties can get a constitutional matter on the ballot. But issue one would have raised that bar to 60% of voters in all 88 counties. It also would have required 60% of voters to approve subsequent constitutional amendments. Roughly 50% of Ohioans voted against the measure in a special election held yesterday. Their decision has ramifications for the future of pro-family legislation as well. The general election in November will include a radical pro-abortion referendum. Tuesday's vote will make it easier to amend the state constitution and to ultimately enshrine the murder of unborn babies in state law. The proposed amendment says that every individual has a right to make and carry out one's reproductive decisions, including abortion and contraception. There's no age restriction in that language. As Ed Martin of the Eco Forum wrote in an op-ed for The Hill, if this amendment passes, it will embolden anti-parent efforts in every corner of the country. Ohio is the only state to vote on abortion this year. Abortion is legal in Ohio until 21 weeks and 6 days into pregnancy. A heartbeat bill passed in 2019, but that law can't go into effect while litigation is playing out. The defeat of Issue 1 is also a blow to constitutional government in the state. Writing for The New American Online, Peter Rykowski explains that the U.S. Constitution requires every state to maintain a Republican form of government, one that protects individual rights from the tyranny of the majority. Unfortunately, both the federal and state governments are moving away from this essential principle. One of the ways this is happening is by the growing implementation and use of referendums and popular initiatives on the state level. And is there more to the story of this Ohio special election? It turns out that voters had some problems with ballot machines malfunctioning. Here's investigative journalist Mike Holden talking about that.
Hey there, guys. Mike Holden here from News 5. We are in Cuyahoga Falls, and we are tracking the latest on the special election here in Ohio. And there's a bit of an issue here. So I'm going to take you right over to the scanners, and they read the following message. There is a ballot jam in the front and the back. Ask a poll worker for help. As I shift around, Dave Kraska, photojournalist. Same message on here. This has resulted in people not being able to cast their ballot immediately. So what they can do in the interim is put their ballots in this orange box, and it will be scanned later, or they can void the ballot and come back. But people are concerned, and they're very upset, and they're making calls to the Board of Elections right now in Summit County. So we're staying on top of it. Here's a little line. There were more people before. Watch News 5. We'll bring you the latest updates on air online.
Interesting. And for our last story, Niger is an unstable country that recently went through a military coup. And although most Americans can't find it on a map, it has the potential to affect the United States. Niger is a sprawling African country lying partly in the Sahara Desert. It was once the seat of the great Songhai Empire. It has since declined into one of Africa's remotest and most isolated countries. Modern Niger has hosted many coups and uprisings, including at least five full-fledged coups in the last 50 years. There's been two since 2020. The latest coup has gotten the attention of Western internationalists because it ousted Mohamed Bazoum, a leftist who helped start the Nigerian Party for Democracy and Socialism in 1990. He's also been connected to previous coups in Niger. Now he's being held by the military for massive corruption and for selling out Niger to French neocolonial interests. The two major international organizations in Africa are the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States. They're threatening to invade Niger to overthrow the military government. Niger's neighbors, Mali and Burkina Faso, however, have sided with the leaders of the coup. Normally, this wouldn't be important outside of West Africa, but it turns out the U.S. actually has military bases in that country and 1,000 total troops stationed there. American soldiers have been in the country for a decade, supposedly to help with anti-terrorism efforts. Since the coup, they've been confined to base, and the Biden administration is doing everything it can to get Bazoum back in power. Niger is one of the world's top producers of uranium, making it a pawn in nuclear politics. It's believed that Russia's infamous Wagner Group is lurking about in neighboring countries and that they may go into Niger to ensure Russian influence there. Like it or not, we're there too, caught up in yet another needless foreign entanglement as part of our seemingly endless mandate to be the world's policeman. Steve, why in the world do we have so many U.S. soldiers in Niger?
Well, the details are a little bit murky, but the Niger kind of straddles the Sahara Desert and the region south of it called the Sahel. And in that region, not only in Niger, but also in neighboring Mali, there's been a rather strong ISIS-aligned, you know, terrorist movement,
okay,
which is kind of a shame. Mali in particular has a reputation for being an interesting and very tolerant country. It's where the famous city of Timbuktu is located.
Wasn't and, Mali nice? Isn't Mali nice too, like a tropical place?
Well, I don't know about that, but so Mali is this repository of, you know, ancient, relatively ancient, you know, Islamic culture in sub-Saharan Africa, and the city of Timbuktu was actually, with all of its enormous libraries, was overrun a few years ago by these and temporarily occupied by an ISIS type militia group, and they started setting up, you know, one of their typical terror states. So it is a real problem there. The question is, why should it be our problem? Niger was also involved, was also invoked, so-called Nigerian yellow cake, Nigerian yellow cake, the source of, you know, as a pretext for the war in Iraq. Supposedly Saddam Hussein had acquired it and was using it to, it turned out to be false. But anyway, Niger has cropped up a couple of times in major stories, primarily because of the fact that it is the world's seventh largest producer of uranium, believe it or not. So a number of power brokers, including not only the U.S. but also the French, to clarify, Niger, like many West African countries, was once a French colony. French is still spoken; it is the official language there because the dominant ethnic groups, the Hausa, the Songhai, the Fulani, the Tuareg, you know, have all their own languages. So French is sort of a link language used there. So anyway. But then the Russians, of course, are interested, particularly via the Wagner Group. Anyway, they're in the area making trouble as well. So who knows? The point is, we're kind of in the middle of this, and it could well turn out to be. I mean, as of right now, the government of Niger has closed its airspace and are bracing for what they expect to be a multinational invasion of other African states like Nigeria, which lies to the south. Presumably, you know, Cameroon and Senegal and some of the other major states in that area might all come in. On the other hand, several, you know, Mali and also Burkina Faso have said, well, no, we support Niger. And a lot of it is being portrayed as a sort of anti-French colonial thing.
Is that the military's reason for taking over for the coup? What is their stated reason?
Well, their stated reason is that this guy Bazoum, who is clearly a pretty well-connected internationalist with all the right beliefs. He's a perfervid socialist. His party, which he founded back in 1990, is a member of the Socialist International. So he's pretty well connected, you know, particularly for someone who comes from a relatively obscure, African country, relatively obscure, not large in population either. But the official reason is that, you know, they're saying ironically, a couple months ago, Giorgio Meloni, the Italian prime minister, went viral for criticizing Macron and his African policy as being neo-colonial for precisely that reason. So now she's back in the spotlight because that is, in fact, what the people who overthrew Bazoum were saying, that he's just looting the country or allowing the French to loot the country in various creative ways, that he's a pawn in, you know, French internationalist corruption and so forth and so on. And so this is the reason that Mali and Burkina Faso, which at one time were also French colonies as well.
Right.
Burkina Faso was called the Upper Volta when it was under France. Anyway, why they're lining up in sympathy and why perhaps countries like Ghana and Nigeria, which were not French but were British colonies, are less sympathetic.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for that history lesson, too.
No problem.
Well, that's it for our news segment today, folks. Remember to go to thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And we will see you right after the break with more New American TV.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, "Welcome to the singularity." She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Yesterday, we broadcast the first part of an interview that Christian Gomez conducted with Congressman Glenn Grofman of Wisconsin. Grofman is the chairman of the House Subcommittee hearing on Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. The part of the interview we broadcast yesterday was all about UAPs, also known as UFOs. Now we're going to play the rest of the interview, where instead of talking about unknown extraterrestrials, we ask Congressman Grofman about the undeniable illegal aliens who are crossing America's southern border in overwhelming numbers. Let's listen.
Okay, so I'd like to move on now from the topic of unknown extraterrestrials to the undeniable illegal aliens that are crossing our nation's southern border. On Tuesday, August 1st, your office sent out a press release in which both you and Congressman Andy Biggs announced a joint field hearing about the border crisis. Could you tell us about the scope of this hearing and what you hope to come out of it on Tuesday?
I've been to the border before. You do not know what's going down at the border unless you go down there and talk to the Border Patrol, talk to local law enforcement, talk to the ranchers who have land right at the border. And that's what we're going to be doing again. We're going to talk to a local sheriff in Arizona. We're going to talk to a group that monitors what's going on down here and talk to a rancher and maybe later on have private meetings with the Border Patrol. I think we're going to express particular interest in what's going on with the young people. We had a hearing in Washington recently. The New York Times reported that over 80,000 unaccompanied minors, that we had lost track of where they are in an era of human trafficking, which a lot of times means prostitution. It's something we absolutely positively have to look into. It is very frustrating that when we have the hearing, despite the fact we have seven Democrats on that committee, none of them is going to be there. They didn't send any of their staff to be there. And like I said, unless you're down there talking to the people, you really don't get the anecdotal evidence you need. We are told that that people coming here and the cartels, which really control this trafficking, are becoming more aggressive, that we're having more high-speed chases down there, that sometimes Border Patrol is being shot at. We want to hear more about that. And we do want to hear how careful is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. How careful are they to make sure that when we turn a minor over to them, that they are being protected, or that we know the appropriate background on these sponsors?
Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution says, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion." Now, based upon what you know about the border crisis, would you describe the mass border crossings and cartel activity as constituting an invasion? And if such, does the federal government have an obligation to step in and repel this?
Absolutely. I want to emphasize again, we're talking about 200,000 people a month. I mean, that's a massive number of people we haven't done an appropriate background check on. They are accompanying fentanyl coming across this border. Over 100,000 Americans are dying every year of illegal drug overdoses. I always describe it as twice the number of people are dying every year of illegal drug overdoses has died in 12 years in Vietnam. So the impact on American society is horrific beyond belief. the size of people coming here, the degree that when it comes to minors, the our government has completely lost track of where they are, and I'm sure they've lost track of where a lot of the adults are as well. So I think if we ever were invaded, the invasion would probably be not this many people this quick.
Do these drug cartels that operate along the border, do they have any known ties or connections that you know of with, like, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the Marxist guerrillas, or adversaries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Russia, or maybe even China?
Not that I know of, but the danger is there, right? The fentanyl, or at least the ingredients in fentanyl, are coming in from China, and that is what is being turned into the fentanyl. So in that regard, both China and Mexico, or parties from both countries, are involved in what's going on here.
Also, the cocaine leaves are produced in mass quantities throughout northern Peru and in southern Colombia, which are areas dominated by the FARC and the Maoist terrorist group, the Shining Path. So I'm curious if Congress will look into any ties that there could be with those terrorist organizations in South America, if they have any known ties with the cartels that operate in Mexico.
We'll continue to ask those type of questions to our intelligence community. I will point out that you don't see people dying of illegal drugs in China, right? So they have the capability of making sure this does not happen. And if they can prevent fentanyl from destroying their own youth, you would think if they wanted to, they could prevent the fentanyl from destroying our youth.
Now, along the southern border, there's a lot of signs, mostly in English and Spanish, but there are a few signs there that are printed in Mandarin Chinese for people who are crossing the border who happen to only speak Mandarin Chinese or at least be able to read that language. Has there been an increase, as far as you know, in the number of Chinese nationals that are crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S.?
I do not know. What I will point out is, you know, sometimes you think of the southern border, you think of Mexicans, you think of people from Central America. The number of people coming across from all over the world is huge. I was down there a couple of years ago before this Ukraine war. And at that time in the San Diego sector, maybe only for a couple of months, the second most common nationality coming across was Russian. Okay, I think that's illuminating. I was in another sector recently and one of the most common nationalities coming across was from India. Okay, so the American public has to realize people are coming here from a lot of places other than just Central America. There is not a tiny number of Chinese coming across. And like everybody else, we don't know their background. We don't know what their goal is. I noticed recently that we had a couple members of our military, right, who were arrested for doing spying for China. And obviously, the more Chinese people coming here who we do not know their background, the more potential there is for trouble. There are so many problems with the Biden policy of letting everybody in here. And the drugs is one of the problems. Criminal element is one of the problems. Welfare element is one of the problems. And the possibility that people are coming here from foreign countries to spy on our country or undermine our country has also got to be a possibility. I will point out that when people come here from India, they're paying $18,000 to $20,000 to come here. I think a lot of the motive for the Mexican drug cartels is just to make money. And I've been told several times at the border that our Border Patrol believes, I still find it hard to believe, despite the fact I've been told it over 10 times, that the cartels make more money shipping people across the southern border than they do drugs.
Speaking of shipping people, of course, with the recent popularity of the film Sound of Freedom, what are some steps that that you'd like to see Congress take, or that Congress will be taking, to stem the movement of sex trafficking and human trafficking that's coming from the southern border into the U.S.?
Well, if we could, I would always turn around unaccompanied children at the border. I mean, even if the Biden administration weren't trying to turn around anybody else, why under any circumstances? Particularly because the Democrat Party 3 years ago made such a big deal when children were separated from their parents for a week. Why under any circumstances would we have a minor come here without their parents to apparently hang around the United States almost permanently? So I would like to see us introduce legislation saying that children could not come here without both their parents, unless they have some evidence that a parent had died or something. Make sure they had both their parents here, and that would solve a lot of the problem. Right now, we don't do that. The New York Times, if you could trust them, they claim that there are 85,000 unaccompanied minors that we don't know where they are, which is kind of a shockingly high number. And obviously, with 85,000 people under the age 18, I'm sure a lot of these people have promised the drug cartels, given amount of money they're going to send back. It's just ripe for human trafficking. And like I said, human trafficking to me normally means prostitution.
So, Lee, and this is my final question. As Congress works on the budget for fiscal 2024, what are the chances that we can get appropriations to repair any dilapidated portions of the border wall, or to add to the border wall and finish the job that President Trump started?
Well, I think it would take a Republican Party that was prepared to shut down the government. I don't think they're prepared to do that at this time. I am sure there's going to be a lot of debate over what's going on at the southern border, both the number of people there and trying to persuade the Biden administration to change the policies with Mexico to try to keep more people back in Mexico than coming here. I think there's also going to be a lot of debate over what we do with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is obviously doing a horrible job of keeping track of where these people wind up.
Well, Congressman Griffin, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and you've given us a lot of interesting information about these various topics. So thank you again, Congressman.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. God bless you. Take care.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
To complete today's program, Christian Gomez interviews constitutional expert Joe Wolverton about why nullification is an important remedy for federal overreach, despite claims to the contrary.
This is Christian Gomez for The New American, and today we're joined by Joe Wolverton, who on July 11th wrote an article titled, Convention of States, Nullification is Not a Remedy for Federal Overreach. Well, Joe, we're glad to have you on, but wow, what a crazy thing for COS to claim. Can you tell us where they made this claim, what they said, and why it's, I don't even have to ask you if it is wrong, why is it wrong?
Well, they have a section, if you go and of their website, where they have, you know, they're busting the myths, right? That's their thing. And so one of them is, you know, they say that nullification can force the federal government into these restraints, but it in this document is called, Is Nullification the Answer? Right. And so if you don't mind, I'll read off the top what they say. The 10th Amendment is a clear expression of a defining foundational principle of the government designed by our founders. So far, so good. That powers not delegated to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved to the states or to the people. Still going fine. But this in and of itself does not imply that individual states have the authority to independently determine when the federal government has acted outside the scope of its authority. Much less does it imply that an individual state, upon reaching this conclusion, may simply ignore a duly enacted federal law. The 10th Amendment establishes a principle, but it does not establish a remedy or process because it doesn't need to. It is a principle, right? When Jesus said, love thy neighbor, he didn't say, by doing the following things. But none of us say, loving thy neighbor is not going to help you get to heaven. because he didn't give us a process for it. Sort it out, man. Use your mind. What does it mean to love your neighbor? What does it mean that if a power is not in the Constitution, it's retained by the states and the people? It means just that. You don't need a process if the process is baked in to the Constitution itself. And this is the thing that they always rely on, that people are not going to critically analyze what happened at the convention, what the Constitution actually is, rather than what COS says it is. Because when they say a single state can't nullify, well, first of all, that's just, where's the process saying that, COS? Where does it say that? And you say it doesn't say that states can nullify, doesn't say it can't, and it doesn't have a process. The fact of the matter is the federal government was created by the states for their benefit. It's called the law of principle and agency, and it's existed since King Alfred, right? If I create a government, that government is meant to serve me, because it would make no sense for me to create a government to make law for me if that law the government was going to make, the government that I created, was going to make me poorer and less free. That makes no sense. So to say there's not a what is it, process, there doesn't need to be one. The process is what you just did is unconstitutional. I'm therefore contractually obliged to ignore it, because every one of us sitting here in the state legislature took an Article 6 oath to support the Constitution. And what you're proposing, Washington, is something that, rather than being in pursuance of the Constitution, is in violation of the Constitution. Therefore, I am oath-bound to not participate in that. And there is nothing that the federal government does that it could do if the states refused to cooperate in those things, period. So there doesn't need to be a process when that principle guides everything that is known as the United States Constitution. The fact, all you would have to do, Christian, and maybe I should do this, maybe I should send a copy of Madison's notes on the convention to Mark Meckler. Maybe if we did that and, you know, give him, maybe get rent an Airbnb for him and say, take a weekend, buddy, read this, read that what you're saying is not true. And maybe he'll come out and join our side, right? Because he's going to be intellectually honest and say, they were right. There doesn't need to be a process, because this is what the Constitution is built on. The fact that the states created a contract, and in that contract, they created a government, and that government is bound within the four corners of that contract. And he'll come out and he'll be on our side, and we'll all start following the Constitution. It'll be wonderful, because that's all it takes. Because the 10th Amendment, you don't need a process. The process is the fact that the Constitution is a contract establishing the limits of power, right? It's principal agency. And he talks about how all these lawyers are going to be the ones doing it. They brag. That's what blows my mind. They brag that at the convention, it's going to be all politicians and lawyers. Well, that really boosts my confidence in that they're going to be, you know, wise and virtuous. You just named the two groups of people that Americans trust least, politicians and lawyers. And so when you talk about there needs to be a process for nullification, no, there doesn't. The states created that position known as federal government. The contract says you can do X, Y, and Z. Guess what? If you do V, we don't have to follow it. That's the procedure. Retained. The word retained by the states and the people, that's the procedure.
In your article, you discuss examples of nullification. You start to get into, for example, marijuana, regardless of one's position on that. So can you just discuss with us further nullification as it relates to the federal government overstepping its authority in, let's say, the area of marijuana?
Right. Well, the first thing is the COS document, and it points to that in other places, would say that's a duly enacted federal law. Well, it isn't, because to be a law, according to Article 6, it has to be in pursuance of the powers granted to Congress. And there is no power granted to Congress to outlaw plants, period. There is no. So it isn't, as he would have you believe, a duly enacted federal law. But for the sake of argument, let's say it was. And you were against, you don't like people. You don't smoke marijuana. You don't want people to smoke it. But you do realize that there's no authority given to the federal government to do that. And so you say, we're not going to enforce that duly enacted federal law. Well, there are 20 states, or the total, there are 20 states in the District of Columbia have legalized recreational use. Well, the federal law hasn't been repealed. And it wasn't like the states, because he said individual states cannot nullify unconstitutional acts of the feds. Well, 20 of them have, and they did it individually, and they never asked permission of anyone else. But they said, if you move to Colorado, smoke up. If you move to Nevada, Arizona, all of these states, they never asked permission of another state. They never needed a process. They simply said, that's not constitutional. We're going to pass a law saying you can smoke it here. And there you go. You can. You can walk around. You can go to 20 states in the union and see that nullification works, Christian. You may not like the way it's working right now with regard to marijuana, but we can do that to any unconstitutional act of the federal government, period. Simple as that.
Of course, that
word
requires
retain.
That requires lawmakers to be educated on the Constitution, not to be deceived by COS into thinking that they're hamstrung. They don't have the power to try to nullify unconstitutional acts of the federal government. So when COS is spending millions of dollars to say that nullification is not the answer, to say that the John Birch Society is wrong, even the 10th Amendment Center, that these folks are all wrong, what they're actually doing a favor to the federal government. They're saying whatever the feds do, it's okay. It's the supreme law of the land, which is the same argument that the left makes with the whole living constitution philosophy. So it's amazing.
They literally say in this
states,
document, Christian, that if the Supreme Court says it's constitutional, well, it's constitutional because Article 6 says the Supreme Court is the final. What? That is not true. He goes right out and says Article 3 grants to the Supreme Court the power to decide, be the final decider in what is constitutional or not. It doesn't say that. And then he says Article 6 says that whatever they say is the supreme law of the land. It doesn't say that. But Article 6 does say that state legislators and state governors and state judges are obliged to support the Constitution by oath. It does say that. It doesn't say what he says, but it does say that state legislators, governors, and judges must take an oath to support the Constitution. So why don't we do that? Let's do that. Let's go down and go to your state legislator and say, did you take an oath under Article 6? Did they have you do that when you got elected? Yes. Are you being faithful to that oath? And he's going to say, well, of course. Then have ready a printout of his votes and say, and have a little red mark or something, say, that's not in the Constitution. That's not in the and show him. There are some good people, Christian, who are state legislators. And I have worked with some that have admitted, you know what? When you said that, I started thinking differently. And we can have that effect. You can't do that to Washington, right? You can't compete against the billions and trillions of dollars and all of that. But you can have effect on your state legislator. And you can go down and you can explain this to him, right? And
absolutely.
And like what you said, the fact that they're spending millions to advertise, to publish, to pretend that the 10th Amendment won't work to force the federal beast back inside his constitutional cage is mind-boggling, because when you look at it, they are doing the work of the other side. They're doing the work of the people they claim to be fighting against, which are the socialists, the leftists. They're doing that work by saying, federal government, you're in charge. Whatever you say, it goes.
Well, Joe, thank you for your time. And if those of you that are watching, again, we recommend that you strongly read the article, Convention of States, Nullification is Not a Remedy for Federal Overreach. Print this article, meet with your legislators, talk with them, and even show them in the end of the article where Joe Wolverton, who we just spoke with, quotes even from James Madison and from Federalist number 46 about the concept of nullification. COS loves to quote the founders. With ellipses. Well, let's quote the founders without ellipses and what they actually said. Joe, yeah. Thank you for your time. Take care and God bless.
Thank you, Christian. Same to you.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit newamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day, and we will see you tomorrow.